Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope everyone had a great lunch. I know we did here, and hopefully those of you who went out or went somewhere did as well. I want to also add my well wishes and prayers for Greg Thomas to the chorus of well wishes and prayers for him. Now, I know that this is traditionally nap time for the Church of God. But I will promise you one thing. If you postpone your nap till after services today, I'll keep this short and get you home in time for a nap before sunset. So keep that in mind. For those of you who are into acronyms, I have one for you. The acronym, and some of you here will know what it is, not everyone, but a few of you will. And the acronym is WWJD. We'll get back to that in just a minute. But now that we've come to the end of the Holy Days, in a few short hours when the sun sets, goes over the horizon, and is gone for another year as far as the spring Holy Days are concerned, now that we've come to that conclusion, where do we go from here? I know this morning Greg Thomas, in his abbreviated message, had gotten into the meaning or what happened on this last day. Well, I want to go on from there and go forward into the future. We know that the symbolism that was portrayed during these days and through the Passover of leaven as sin was an apt one, and now that is over. So is that the end of it? Or what have we learned? Have we learned things? Are we just going back to the same old? Hopefully not. Hopefully we will put these things into practice in our life as we go forward and as we go through the year. Put some water down here to try to keep me hydrated and from my mouth from getting so dry. Getting back to the acronym WWJD, as some of you know, what it means is, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? It's an acronym that down in our area, and when I say our area, I'm talking about Holmes County, Ohio, where there's a high concentration of religious people, whether they be Amish, Mennonite, or variations thereof. And that gets bandied about from time to time. It gets revived. It'll go for a while, and you won't hear much about it. And then all of a sudden, it'll pop up again, and everybody will be using that acronym or that particular saying, what would Jesus do? But is that really the question that we should be asking? Is that the most pertinent question that we could ask about our life or about Christ, about what we want to do in our life? When we think about that and we start applying that, here's how it works. We'll say, well, in this circumstance, I think Jesus would do this. I think Jesus would do this. Well, that sentiment may be partially true, but the problem is with the first two words. I think. That's what I think, which leaves us a lot of latitude for interpretation, a lot of latitude to decide what would we want to do. And we'll just take it from there. For example, a lot of people might say or think, well, Jesus would want me to go to church every Sunday morning. Well, that sounds, you know, in a lot of people's mind, that would sound like a pretty fair assessment, an assumption. But first of all, it's not true. it's not true. Now, I do want to give credit where credit is due. I'm not the first one to bring this up. I'll have to credit John Miller for saying this. I've heard him say it a number of times, and we've discussed it, and I've said it on a number of occasions myself. But a better question is, what did Jesus do? That's concrete. We have evidence of it. The Bible is filled with examples of what Jesus did, and what that means is that we can base our life on what Jesus did instead of what we think that he would do. Now, we know, and there is no doubt about it, that there are certain things we know Jesus would do. But it gives us too much latitude when we say, I think, or what would Jesus do, and then go from there. It gives us a lot of room for error. It gives us a lot of room to make the wrong decisions, come to the wrong conclusions. I would like to lay a more concrete foundation of what Jesus did and what a spiritual, unleavened life would include. It's not going to be comprehensive. I promised you I'd keep this short, so to be comprehensive and all-inclusive, it would take a lot more time than I have today, and quite frankly, a lot more information than I even have. But what should we do as we look at what Jesus Christ did now that unleavened bread, the days of unleavened bread, the typology of yeast or leaven is behind us, and we go forward in our life. We continue to move forward, and we continue to try the best we very best we can to live according to the instructions laid out in our Bible by Jesus Christ and his servants for us. So again, I'll ask the question, what did Jesus do? How did he conduct his life? And again, I'm going to use some very simple and very basic things we already know, but I want to reinforce it and maybe put a little bit of a different twist on a couple of things so that we can grab onto some things, latch onto some things, and maybe it'll help us in a couple areas. It's easy, for example, we know that Jesus Christ, and I'm not going to belabor these points, we know that Jesus Christ kept the Sabbath. Jesus Christ was Jewish, and so he was going to be doing what Jews of his time did, and that was keep the Sabbath. It's easy to demonstrate that he did that. He kept the Sabbath as his custom was. We read in a number of places, especially in Luke 4:16, we won't turn there, but that's one of the places that we can find that. But that's a simple and a pretty easy thing for us to do. He kept the holy days that we're keeping now. He kept the holy days. He was Jewish, so he did what they did, not just to do it because they did, but because it was the right thing to do. It was something that he and his father had instituted long before the time of Christ. So he did that. We know that. John 7, again, we won't go there. But in John 7, he kept the Feast of Tabernacles at great peril to himself. They were looking to kill him. They were looking to find him, catch him in some flaw, and then stone him or kill him. A lot of his life was lived in that manner, evading those who wanted to kill him. It's different than it is in our days. If I want to know what Louis Pettit looks like, I can get on the internet and I can probably find a picture of him, so I can see what he looks like, or Art Blakey, or any of a lot of other people. I can get on the internet, I can pull up some pictures, and that's what he looks like. Well, they couldn't do it that in his day. He looked like an average Jewish man of his age in that time period. So he was able to slip in and slip out a little bit more anonymously than today we would probably be able to do. And when it came time for the Feast of Tabernacle that particular year, his disciples and others, his brothers, said, "Hey, are you coming up to the feast with us?" And he said, "No, you guys go ahead." So when they had left, he came, and he was able to sort of slip in without being detected. But it still was at jeopardy of his life. We also know, for example, that he ate, and I'll use this term, kosher, or clean foods, because, again, he was Jewish, and he did what everybody else did in his time. And, again, not just because they did it, but because it was the right thing to do, and he knew that. He knew that it was the right thing to do. It was the thing that he should do. He was a practicing Jew. But we want to consider a few things that are a little more, even more fundamental than this, on how did Jesus Christ live his life. Again, nothing new, nothing dramatic, but it's the kind of things that can help us to live our life more successfully as a Christian, as a disciple of Jesus Christ. 1 John, second chapter, 1 John 2, and we're going to read verses 3 to 6, if you would come there with me. It says, "By this we know that we know him," and that's him being Jesus Christ, "if we keep his commandments." Jesus Christ was a commandment keeper. That's what he did. He was a commandment keeper. Jesus Christ gave the commandment. 1 John, the Gospel of John, the first chapter tells us that Jesus Christ, without Jesus Christ, nothing was made that was made. He was the Word, and he's the instrument through which everything that was put in place was put in place. So we know that he made the commandments as well. "By this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, 'I know him,' and does not keep his commandments is a liar." He who says he knows him and doesn't keep his commandments says he is a liar. And the truth is not in him. Matthew, the 7th chapter, again, we won't go there, but in Matthew 7, you can jot this down for reference, 21 to 23, it talks about somebody coming to Christ and saying, "Hey, let me in. In your name, we've done many wonderful things." But he said, "You are going to be on the outside. I do not know you, you who practice lawlessness. You who do not keep the commandments." 1 Peter, the 2nd chapter, just back a couple of pages in my Bible, 1 Peter 2, and in verse 21. "For this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow his footsteps." That we should follow his footsteps. I want to go back there to John, the 2nd chapter, and finish that up. We stop there at the commandments. "But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God," in verse 5, 1 John 2, "and keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him, and he who abides in him," or he who stays in him, "he who keeps with him, ought himself also to walk just as he did." What did Jesus do? WDJD, what did Jesus do? That's what it's saying here. We ought to walk just as he did. And then coupling that with verse 21 of 1 Peter 2, it says, "Jesus left us an example that we should walk in his footsteps." And we know that we are to emulate and follow Jesus Christ. That's not news to us. But I want to go to some fundamental things that Jesus Christ did in his life. That as we go forward, if we do these things, we also will be stronger, and it will help us in our walk with Jesus Christ, in our Christian life, it'll help us to become better. I've got a question for you. Who likes to fast? Boy, I don't see very many hands, and I'll tell you one thing. Neither do I. I've never liked to fast, but I, you know, obviously on the Day of Atonement we fast, and hopefully at other points as well. Now, fasting for us is not easy most of the time. I fasted one time, I thought, well, you know what, maybe I should fast every week. So I started doing that for a little while. And you know what happens? It became sort of commonplace. It got to the point where it wasn't really a big deal for me. And it lost its value. It lost its meaning. It was much better for me when I did it on an irregular basis as I felt I needed to, when I felt I needed to. Jesus Christ fasted. And Jesus Christ taught his followers to fast. But I want to point out some things or something about Jesus Christ fasting. The big place where we find this is in Matthew, the fourth chapter. Matthew, the fourth chapter in verse 1 says, Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterwards, he was hungry. That's a big understatement, I would think. Afterwards, he was hungry. And I would say this, do not try that. Physical human beings, we can't do that. They would take us out into the cemetery before we got through all of that. We can't do it. I do know a person who did or tried to do that, and that person is dead. He died at like in his 50s because he tried to do that and he wasn't able to. Now, I don't know that he fasted from one end to the other without anything, but he did it in long periods of time and he tried to do it for like 40 days, work up to 40 days, but it can't be done by today's human beings. So don't try that. And Jesus Christ nowhere requires that of us. Now, when the tempter came, it says in verse 3, to him he said, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. Wouldn't that be nice? Jesus had the power to do that. And he was very hungry. But he also had the power to resist giving in to the temptation that Satan was putting before him. And he answered, that being Christ, said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, we all know that he fasted, and I'm sure he fasted other times besides this as well. We all know that. But I wanted to bring this up for one important reason. Jesus Christ took this opportunity to fast when he was coming up on the most important event or most important challenge that he was going to face early in his ministry. He took this opportunity to fast because he knew that he was facing a challenge that he was not going to be able to stand without his Father's support. That's what we need to do. And that's why I brought it out. That we as well need to fast when we have important crises, important events, important things coming up in our life. That's when we need to take the opportunity to decide, hey, we need to fast. We need to get closer to God. We need to draw near God and resist the devil, and the devil will flee from us. In important points of our life, we need to take that opportunity. Maybe we're getting ready to be baptized. Maybe we're counseling for baptism. A very good time to fast, because we need that to strengthen us and to keep us close to our God. Jesus Christ did not just fast himself. He also taught his followers to fast. in Matthew, the sixth chapter. Matthew 6, and we'll read verses 16 to verse 18. Here he's telling his followers in verse 16, when you fast, didn't say if you fast, it was already a foregone conclusion and an obligation that he was putting on them that you are to fast. When you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. That is their reward, the accolades and the admiration or the admiration of other people. They already have received their reward. They're not going to get anything else from it because they go around in a, woe is me, oh, look at me. I'm fasting. I am having struggles. I'm struggling to do this. And we know that there were, that the Pharisees did that. They wanted it, they even, for their prayers and fasting, they even had somebody go in front of them blowing horns and doing things, bringing attention to themselves. That's not what we're to do. He said that when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites, but wash up, clean up, look good, be cheerful, which is difficult to do. But that's what we are to do. In verse 17, but you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father will reward you openly. That's the way we're supposed to do it. Now, maybe his disciples did not do it as much while he was with them. In fact, it says in Matthew, the ninth chapter, verses 14 and 15. In verse 14, it said, the disciples of John came to him saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples don't fast at all? Well, he told them why, because I'm here. They're already close to me. I'm here, and they don't need to do it as much. But he said, when I'm gone, but the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away, he being the bridegroom, which we heard about that in the opening message, in the sermonette. When the bridegroom will be taken away from them, then they will fast. He expected them to fast. It was basically a commandment that they will be fasting, and they need to be fasting at that point. That's one of the things that we want to keep in our minds, that we want to incorporate into our life a little bit more. I know there are times when probably you as well as me, when we fast periodically, and then maybe there are times when we let it slip for a while. But we do need to keep doing it on a regular basis. I'm not saying that we need to say every second Tuesday of the month, I'm going to fast. But especially on occasions when we are going to be facing strong challenges. It's one of the things that Jesus Christ did. What did Jesus Christ do? That was one of them. There's another thing. And it's just as basic as fasting, and that is he prayed. Of course he prayed. Everybody knows that he prayed. Jesus Christ was trying to stay as close and into as close a communication with his Father as he possibly could, because he knew he was going to go through a strong struggle in his life. He had a burden of responsibility that none of us ever had, and that is to be perfect and to be sinless his entire life. Now I want to show you one particular in Mark, the first chapter. Mark 1, and we'll look at verses 35 and to 37, an example of Jesus Christ praying. praying. Jesus Christ was inundated with crowds, as you might imagine. If you had the power to heal like he did, and if you had some of the miraculous powers that access to that he did, I'm guessing you would gather crowds, and I would draw crowds. Because when people are sick, when people are ill, when they're handicapped, when they're in distress, when maybe they were in an accident, whatever it is, and you had the power to heal, a lot of people would flock to you for that reason. So he had to do things maybe a little different than we do. It says now, verse 35, in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and he departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. He went to a solitary place and prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and when they found him, they said to him, everybody's looking for you. Where have you been? What happened to you? You had us worried sick. We couldn't find you. Where were you? But the point I wanted to make here is Jesus Christ knew that prayer was not going to happen by accident, just by chance. He made provision and made time for prayer. He was, in the today's vernacular, he was intentional about praying. I know I want to pray every day. But unless I make plans for it, provisions for it, it's not going to happen. I get up in the morning and, oh wow, I overslept. It's later than I thought. Wow, I know I was going to pray, but wow, I just don't have time. I have got to get to work. I have to get going. I have important things to do. You know what? I wasn't intentional about it. I did not wake myself. I found in my life the key to getting up is going to bed. If we go to bed and get the required amount of sleep, it's a lot easier for us to get up on time. But then we need to make a time and say, this is when I need to get up because I want to pray before I go to work, or I want to pray before the day gets started. I want to pray early when my mind is still clear. That's me. Maybe you guys' mind is clear later in the evening, but I probably have what they call sundowners, which is I get sort of foggy and groggy as the day wears on towards the end. But at any rate, if we want to do that, same thing goes for Bible study. If we want to do that, we're going to have to make provision for it. We're going to have to make plans for it. We're going to have to do it by intentionally providing for it, a time, a place, and that's what Jesus Christ did here. In the morning, having risen a long day, or a long time before daylight, he went and departed to a solitary place, a place where he could have privacy, a place where he was not going to be interrupted. And that's the kind of thing that we need to do as well. We need to make provision for it. He didn't just pray himself, but he also taught his disciples and his followers to pray as well. And we know the place where this is, Matthew, the 6th chapter. Matthew 6, he gave him an outline of how to pray. But he said before then, in verse 7, he didn't say, if you pray. He said, when you pray, and then he outlines what they are to do. Don't use vain repetitions as the heathen do. They think that for all their verbiage and all of the grandiose things they say, they think that they will be heard, and what a great guy I am because I can pray, you know, I can pray for 2 hours and not say anything. And that's basically what he's telling them here. Don't use vain repetitions. It doesn't have to be a long prayer. What it has to be is a heartfelt, direct to God kind of a prayer. That's what he's teaching them here. When you pray, do not use vain repetitions as the heathen do. They think that they'll be heard for their many words. Therefore, and then he gives them that outline, our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name, and so on. It goes through verse 13, and you can read that as you go, as you do some of your studies. Matthew 6, 7 through 13. Here is another important thing that we sometimes overlook that Jesus Christ did that will help us walking an unleavened life going forward. He practiced what he preached. In other words, what he said is what he did. And that's what we should do. He didn't ask others to do things that he was not willing to do himself. What he asked others to do was the same things that he did. We are to walk in his steps. We are to walk as he did. We are to follow his example. And that's why he did it. He taught his followers that same thing. One of the things that we can look at in this particular manner, for this example, is the thing we just went through, the Passover. It was Jesus Christ setting an example for his followers. And in John, the big thing here is in John the 13th chapter. John the 13th chapter. It goes from verse 4 through 17, but we're not going to read all of that. We're just going to look at verse 15 through 17. He took a bowl as supper was taking place, took a bowl and a towel, filled the bowl with water, and he went to each and every one of his 12 disciples, 12 apostles, and washed their feet. This was an unheard of thing. This was not the kind of thing that was done, that the master would wash the servant's feet. But it was an example that he wanted them to get. He wanted them to learn the humility of it. He wanted them to learn the servitude of it. He wanted them to do the same thing that he did. In verse 15, he says, after he had done this, I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. That you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. He wanted his disciples to learn these examples, humility and service. He did them. He wanted us to do them. He lived an unleavened life, and we can live an unleavened life by following his example. And that's what we should do. In chapter 5 of Matthew, part of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 of the book of Matthew, which is the longest dissertation on discipleship that's in the Bible, starts in verse 38. And I will tell you, this is one of the hardest things that people have to learn, that I have to learn. And I'll be quite frank, I'm not good at it, and I need to do better. And I would venture to say a lot of us are in the same boat. Verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever hits you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. It's a popular expression, turn the other cheek. Whoever hits you on the cheek, slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other one to him also. It's not easy. It is not easy to do. It is very difficult to do. When somebody attacks you, physically, verbally, in any manner, it is really, really difficult to resist firing right back. That's why fights get started in bars. Guy comes up and one guy pushes the other guy and the other guy hits him and then they both start hitting. Next thing you know, you got a full-blown brawl. Happens at sporting events because somebody spills beer on somebody and next thing you know, they're all, a whole section is embroiled in a big fight. It happens all the time. It is very difficult to let it go, to turn the other cheek, and to not reciprocate in kind. Jesus did, and that's what we need to learn to do as well. Going forward, as we try to live that unleavened life. Let's just read a little bit more here. I tell you not to resist an evil person. In verse 40, if anyone wants to see you, take away your tunic, let him also have your cloak. Whoever compels you to go a mile, go two with him. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from him or from you, do not turn away. Now, it's going to get a little more intense here in a minute when I read these next chapters. Jesus Christ's last day and last night were the perfect exemplification of this. He could have, he said, called down legions and scores of angels to help him, stand up for him, fight for him, and to get him out of this mess if he had so chosen. But he didn't. He knew for the time that was not the right thing to do. He left us an example that each one of the Gospels, we won't go to them, but in each one of the Gospels, the last couple of chapters are filled with what happened to Jesus Christ on that last day and night, or night and day of his life, and ending in his crucifixion. Now, we just went over a lot of that through the days of unleavened bread, or the Passover specifically. And Jesus Christ, though, passed the test. He did what he said. He practiced what he preached. He did what he wanted us to do, and he showed us what he wanted us to do and how to do it. He did that. But here's where it gets even, I would say, it gets intensified a little bit. In 1 Peter 2, we're going to read 20 to 23. I think we already read verse 21, but at any rate, 1 Peter 2, if I get in the right book, I probably can read it. It says here, what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? You know, a lot of us do things, myself first of all, for that we could deserve stripes for, deserve to be beaten for. But he said, Peter's saying here, what credit is it if when they beat us for our own faults? But when you do good and suffer, if you make it take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us. Again, that verse we already read, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. And it explains, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. And verse 23 is what I find so hard to do myself. And many of us probably do. Verse 23. And this is speaking of Jesus Christ, who when he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Let it go. That's what he did. He let it go. That guy cuts me off in traffic. Don't try to get around him and cut him off. Don't try to get back at him. Don't honk your horn. Don't do it. I try to think that when somebody makes a foolish mistake around me in traffic, and it happens all the time, but I realize that I do the same thing myself at times. And that helps me mitigate and try to keep me under control, and it keeps me from making the mistake of trying to retaliate. When he was, verse 23, when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. In other words, revile means when abuse was heaped on him, or when he was reproached, or when he was vilified, which he was his entire ministry. His entire ministry was made up of people humiliating him or trying to, and reproaching him, reviling him, as it says here. And when he suffered, he did not threaten, but again, committed himself to him who judges righteously. If we can learn to live our life that way, we can learn to do things the way Jesus Christ did. We can, like Jesus Christ did, live an unleavened life. Now, I know we will slip up from time to time because we're human beings, and guess what? I do, and so do you. We have human nature. That's what we're fighting against. That's what we're struggling to overcome. We, as we go along in life now, post the days of unleavened bread. We have our work cut out for us. We need to apply what we've learned through these days, the hard bread of affliction that we had. We need to learn to be unleavened. We need to study what Jesus Christ did, not what we think he might do or would do and so forth, but what he did, and then we need to do the same thing. That's what we need to do as well, what Jesus Christ did. What we've looked at here today, just a few basic things. It's not even a small portion of Jesus Christ's life. But we have four Gospels and a lot of commentary through Paul and James and John and Peter and others who wrote books to explain some of the things that Jesus Christ did, what his life was about, what our life should be about as we travel on down this road of discipleship. We should try to do what Jesus Christ did. There's a lifetime more besides what we went through here today. An unleavened life looks like Jesus Christ. And it looks like what Jesus Christ did. An unleavened life. He fasted because he knew that he needed to get close to his God, his Father, when he was ready to face the most difficult challenges of his life. We need to do the same thing. We need to make it a habitual thing whenever there is something, a big challenge coming into our life that we are facing. We need to do the same thing. He prayed. Well, yeah, we pray too. Sometimes we're driving down the road, and since we got up too late and didn't get our prayer in, sometimes we're going down the road and we're praying till that guy cuts us off, and we sort of lose it a little bit. But at any rate, that's what we need to do. We need to be intentional about our prayer and our Bible study too. We need to make provision for it, cut out a block of time. This is what we're doing. This is when we're doing it. We need to do like Jesus Christ did when he got up early before daylight, went out to a solitary place to pray. And he put into practice what he asked others to do. He put into practice what he preached. Whatever he said to do, he did that same thing. Whether it was the foot washing or whether it was taking and turning the other cheek, whatever it was, Jesus Christ did the same thing. We need to study and learn what Jesus Christ did and do that. And again, there's lots of information in the book. There's lots of things that we can look at and say, hey, what did Jesus do there? That's what he did. That's what I need to do. We can do that. It's not that difficult for us to find it. It's more difficult for us to practice it, to do it. We need to walk as Jesus walked. And if we do, our life can be an unleavened life. I promised you I'd get you out here early, so we're done.